Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The story of a woman whose ambition and accomplishments far exceeded the expectations of her time, 18 Tiny Deaths, follows the transformation of a young wealthy socialite into the mother of modern forensics. Frances Glessner Lee, born a socialite to a wealthy and influential Chicago family in the 1870s, was never meant to have a career, let alone one steeped in death and depravity. Yet she developed a fascination with the investigation of violent crimes and made it her life's work. Best known for creating the Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death, a series of dollhouses that appear charming until you notice the macabre little details, an overturned chair or a blood-spattered comforter. And then, of course, there are the bodies, splayed out on the floor, draped over chairs, clothed in garments that Lee lovingly knit with sewing pins. 18 Tiny Deaths, by official biographer Bruce Goldfarb, delves into Lee's journey from grandmother without a college degree to leading the scientific investigation of unexpected death out of the dark confines of centuries-old techniques and into the light of the modern day. Lee developed a system that used the Nutshell's dioramas to train law enforcement officers to investigate violent crimes, and her methods are still used today. 18 Tiny Deaths transports the reader back in time and tells the story of how one woman, who should never have been allowed into the classroom she ended up teaching in, changed the face of science forever. The book we're featuring this evening is 18 Tiny Deaths, the untold story of Frances Glessner Lee and the invention of modern forensics, with my special guest journalist and author, Bruce Goldfarb. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Bruce Goldfarb.
Hi, Dan. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. This is an incredible story, and I'm sure the audience is going to love it. I know this isn't really the order, but let's go to 2012, and there's 12 or more editors, as you write, touring the state of Maryland's state-of-the-art forensic medical center in Baltimore. And you were all working at an organization of a bunch of news sites that were owned then Great. By AOL, Huffington Post. Tell us about the circumstances in which you came to experience in 2012 the Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death. Tell us about this whole experience and what it led to and how you came to be the author of 18 Tiny Deaths.
Well, I, as you say, I had been for many years committing journalism. I had actually written about the Nutshells many years ago in 1992, so I had a familiarity with the medical examiner's office and had visited several times, but it was in 2012 when I was writing for Patch, these hyperlocal news sites, and there was a gentleman in my community that I covered who worked at the medical examiner's office. He was the director of IT named Mike Eagle. And he's a very interesting fellow and a firefighter, ex-military, a paramedic. And I just sort of, you know, had, we sort of developed this friendly relationship. And I asked Mike to, the state of Maryland had just built, it was completed in 2010, this brand new, really state-of-the-art, futuristic forensic medical center. And I asked Mike to arrange for a tour for us. And so we did, and we looked around, and they had this gorgeous, brightly lit autopsy suites and a whole biosafety suite and the laboratories. And we saw the We were in the training facility for forensic investigators that was donated by Patricia Cornwell, the novelist. And this is basically a studio apartment where death scenes are staged for training purposes. And he happened to mention, oh, by the way, we have this position that we're trying to fill, looking for an executive assistant for the chief who would be a public information officer. And they're looking for somebody with some medical experience, preferably a media background, who was comfortable dealing with law enforcement, government officials, the public, and these sorts of things. And it honestly sounded written for me. I couldn't think of anybody else who was more suited for that kind of thing. And so I applied, and it did take a while. The state has quite a hiring system, but I got the job. And so it was just having the opportunity to be in the building where the Nutshells were located was an absolute thrill. I became friends with Jerry D. Jerry DeJohowitz, who is the fellow who keeps the keeper of the Nutshell secrets. And he basically asked me to, you can take care of them now. This is your problem. You can change the light bulbs. You can deal with it. That would be great. So I did. And collected documents and photos. They're just it was extraordinary, and had the opportunity to really look at them very closely, like I never had before, inside the cabinets and examine them and those sorts of things. So it really gave me an opportunity to gain a deeper appreciation for them. And also through the job, I met Frances Glessner Lee's family, her descendants, great grandchildren, and great nieces and nephews, and these sorts of things. They would come and visit. Most importantly, I met William Tyer, who is the director and curator of the Glessner House in Chicago, which is now a museum. And, people would, they visit, they're just fascinated by the Nutshells, and they would ask, is there a biography? How can I learn about her? And there wasn't one. And Bill and I had talked about how unfortunate it was that there's so much misinformation about her online and in print. And so it became really obvious that somebody would have to write a biography. It hadn't been done. And I was in a position, I sort of had a bigger picture, not only, had a sense of who she was, but how she fit into the whole issue of the forensic death investigation. So that's how I got pushed in that direction.
As you write in the book, and this is very important, obviously, let's go back in history and explain the coroner system itself that was in its origins and its practical application in the United States. Take us back.
Well, the coroner system, the coroner, the sheriff, the constable, and the justice of the peace, these are all officials that are actually holdovers from the Middle Ages. They date from the medieval England, the 1200s, 1300s, and the coroner in particular was the judicial representative for the crown, the monarchy. And so his main responsibility was to collect things that were owed to the crown. He was first called a crowner, which ended up getting corrupted into coroner, but that's what he was. He represented the crown. And so they did things like investigated shipwrecks and treasure troves. They seized royal fishes, and they also happened to investigate deaths, mainly to see if it were if it was a homicide or a suicide, because there are a number of penalties and fines. There was just a whole wacky system of penalties that they had to pay for various things, such as when a body was found, it had to be accompanied at all times. If you didn't stay with the body, there was a fine for that. You couldn't move the body, you couldn't bury it. Now, back in these days, it wasn't uncommon for it to take days or maybe even weeks for a coroner to actually show up, and the body had to view the body where it was. So it was, you know, understandably quite tempting to perhaps bury it or, you know, cover it with leaves and things. If you buried the body, there's a fine for that too. So if it turned out that the person had taken their own life, suicide was a crime against the crown. You sacrifice, they would confiscate all your property and all your belongings and that. So, and that's what they did. So it wasn't, the coroner doesn't have to have any medical training, doesn't have to have any background in law or anything like that. They would do things by impaneling a coroner's inquest and having people vote on whether it was an accident, homicide, act of God, or whatever.
You also write that the jurors would be forced to be at that crime scene or at a crime scene to observe the body. And as you write, that's problematic in and itself in terms of crime solving, as you explained.
It is. And back in the day, of course, the inquest jury were whoever was locally there at hand. Any adult male was eligible to sit on an inquest jury. Back in the day, an adult male was age 12 or older. So, you know, many of these people, they may have been neighbors. They could have been witnesses. They could have been related to the decedent. These are, for the most part, illiterate farmers with no particular training. And so there was a requirement. It's called the supervisium corporis or corporis. They were required to, upon view of the body, they were required to look at the body, really examine it and look for wounds and these sorts of things. But, you know, absent any sort of medical training, there's really not too much that a person, you know, an untrained person can tell just by looking at a dead body. So, you know, it's not, it leaves a lot to be desired.
You write about 1944 and you offer a statistic, 1.4 Americans died in 1944. And you say one in five were unexpected and sudden deaths. And of these, a small fraction, 1 or 2%, were investigated by qualified medical examiners. Doctors, again, as you say, with specialized training to determine cause and manner of death. At the time, only a few places like Boston, New York, Baltimore, and Newark had competent medical examiners. Tell us what the state of the system, the coroner system, meant in practical terms in 1944 in most of the U.S.
For most of the American history, the United States was on the coroner system. When the North America was colonized by the Europeans, they brought over English common law with them. So we were in the coroner system since the colonial days. Up until the first medical examiner was in Boston in 1877, there was very, very little progress from 1877 up until, you know, the 1930s. So 1940s. So, you know, for a long, long time, progress was very, very painfully slow. And the coroner system, it really is, unfortunately, you know, it's really set up for corruption, bribery, kickbacks, incompetence, indifference. The coroners were often there, and in some places they still are, elected to office. They're politicians, and they run for office, or they're appointed by political people. So the qualifications for the job really had more to do with your political loyalties and affiliations rather than competence or dedication to the job or proficiency or those sorts of things. So that was true for most of the country. Now, you know, there were no doubt very good, well-intended, decent men of good intentions serving as coroners, doing the best they could, but they didn't have any particular training in what we would consider forensic science. So, you know, but it still was a unscientific, less than satisfactory way of something as serious as determining the cause of somebody's death really merits.
As you write, let's talk about Frances Glessner Lee, her parents, the influence of her parents, her father and her mother, and the unusual or non-typical childhood that she had, and when she first thought she had a passion for medicine.
She was, Frances was her parents, John Jacob Glessner, and her mother, Frances Macbeth Glessner. John Jacob owned a piece of, he was in the agricultural machinery business, owned a company that was a part, that became part of International Harvester, and really pretty fabulously wealthy by any standard. And so they had two children. Frances was born in 1877. Her older brother, George, was 7 years older. He was born just days before the Chicago fire. And so they were homeschooled. And the Glessners had the means to afford the finest instructors that they could find. And their children were trained in music and art and dance and the classics and languages and literature and, you know, the natural sciences. And they both played instruments and horseback riding lessons and dance lessons and all these things. And so by the time that they reached the age of majority, by the time they reached adulthood, they had been provided an education that far, far exceeded anything in any that would be provided in high school. Frances didn't go beyond that. She ended up getting married at age 19, 20 years old, and you know, was headed towards a life of a upper middle class, a wealthy wife. Her brother went to Harvard Medical School. He didn't go to Harvard Medical School. He was actually in the business school, but he went to Harvard and he met a friend who was a medical student, George Burgess McGrath. And she had had, even as a child, she'd had an interest in medicine. She had a really rather harrowing experience having her tonsils removed when she was a young child. And that sort of piqued her interest in medical care. She went with her doctor, the country doctor up in New Hampshire, on his rounds, attending to people and those sorts of things. And so she really didn't have an opportunity to act on these things until much later in life. There is a story that you read online that she was forbidden from going to college by her parents and these sorts of things, which is absolutely not true. There was only one place that she wanted to go to school, and that was Harvard Medical School, that she would have. It was Harvard or nothing. They were a Harvard family. Her husband went there, Blew at Lee, and her brother went to Harvard, and George McGrath went to Harvard, and even H.H. Richardson, who was the architect of their Chicago home, he was a Harvard guy. So they were a Harvard family, and Harvard did not admit women until 1945. So that was out of the question. So she missed her chance.
She was married, as you say, to this Blewett Lee, but she tired of the marriage, or it didn't work out in her mind and was unfulfilling, as you write. And so that led her to indulge, we'll say, or explore her artistic passions and interests. The family was very interested in art, but especially interested in music and the symphony in Chicago. Tell us what she does in terms of the interest in those regards.
Well, her mother, Frances Macbeth, was an amazing, remarkable woman. She was a silversmith. She was a very talented seamstress. And she taught Frances from the earliest childhood in all sorts of needlework, sewing, knitting, crochet, and these sorts of things. And so it was like second nature to her. The whole family, Frances, she made her own clothes and these sorts of things as an adult. She made her clothes for her children. And donated to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. They were big fans of the cultural arts, and particularly the symphonic music. And so they went to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra a lot, and they had personal relationships with the conductor and many musicians, and they often had the entire orchestra to their home for dinner and these sorts of things. And so sort of on a whim, her mother had remarked, you know, how wonderful would it be just to have the orchestra here, you know, all the time in the house. And so that got Frances to thinking to recreate the entire Chicago Symphony Orchestra in miniature. She did, there were 90 figures, all in the scale of 1 inch to 1 foot, and she made the clothing, evening dress with a little carnation in the lapel, and the musical instruments. Some were fabricated, some were acquired. A small harp was made for her by a harp company, along with a little case for it and everything. And this thing ended up being 8 feet long. She had a carpenter create a raised podium, a stair-step podium like that. And she did this entire thing, the 90 pieces in 90 days. That was 3 months of work. A year or so later, she did a quartet, the Flanzelli Quartet, which was a huge deal. They're sort of the Foo Fighters of string quartets of the day. And she did those 4 pieces in the same scale. And so this was, this was part of her background. This is what people did. Miniatures were much more of a thing. Her neighbor, she had a neighbor and a friend. Our listeners may be familiar with Narcissa Thorne, the Thorne Rooms, that are these well-known miniatures that are on exhibit at the Art Institute of Chicago. And Frances Glessner Lee and Narcissa Thorne were friends and neighbors and contemporaries, but dollhouses and miniatures were much more of a thing. They're quite popular today, but it was much more common back then.
Now, you write about her obsession to detail, and that's going to be important to everything that she does, is that a need to have incredible detail and control, and she's very, very persistent and very, very energetic in her pursuits. Tell us how she comes to know, or brother meets George McGrath, as you write, her brother George. Well, tell us how she comes to find out more about what McGrath is all about and what he's interested in, and what their relationship develops into from that point.
It's really very quite interesting because, you know, she had, as you said, she had been married for a while. It didn't stick. It was not a happy marriage, and they separated, or they divorced. She was sort of looking for something to do. In World War I, she volunteered with a settlement home in Boston for soldiers returning from World War I. And she had the sense of, you know, public service. She said that she felt that she had been born with a silver spoon in her mouth, and she'd never had to work a day in her life for what she had, and she felt a need to do something. for others to justify her existence. And through the 1920s, she operated an antique shop with her daughter. But by 1929, she was really at a deep point in her life. Her daughter, she closed up the antique shop. Her daughter got married and weren't doing that any longer. She had some health problems, and her brother had died, her only sibling. And summer of 1929, she was just really in a funk, and she was in the hospital recuperating from a surgical procedure at Phillips House in Boston. And who should be there at the same time, hospitalized, recuperating, was George Burgess McGrath, who unfortunately had cellulitis in both of his hands, a very, very serious condition. And he was being treated for that. And so they just, you know, they're old friends. They hadn't seen really hung out like that in, you know, decades. They knew each other when she was a teenager. And there she is in middle age. And it's pretty much, you know, her dearest friend at that point that she'd known longer than anybody else. And McGrath really seemed to accept Frances in a way that nobody else did, really sort of got her and appreciated that how smart she was and well-read she was. And they had all these common interests in music and art and culture and these sorts of things. So no doubt they had some fascinating conversations, but they're recuperating there at Phillips House. And now McGrath was a pathologist. And near as I can tell, he was the first pathologist to be appointed as a medical examiner. So he was actually the first forensic pathologist in Boston in 1907. And he had this reputation as a crime doctor. He was the medical examiner at the 1919 Boston molasses disaster, that horrible thing when the tank ruptured and all these people were killed. He was the medical examiner at Sacco and Vanzetti case. Investigated Babe Ruth's first wife. She died under mysterious circumstances, and a few really high profile cases, Florence Small, and those sorts of things. You know, she was just absolutely fascinated. You know, these were conversations of things of substance. You know, I mean, she had been for years going to, you know, social events and decorative art society and talking about engraving and these sorts of things. But this was, you know, things that really mattered. And she came to realize that nobody was doing this. There was this yawning need for a modern medical model of death investigation, and nobody was doing it. Nobody was filling that need. And it really did turn her mind, that McGrath really planted the seed in her mind. That eventually grew into supporting what was then called legal medicine, now called forensic medicine, forensic science. And she spent the rest of her life towards that purpose, to modernize how deaths are, sudden and unexpected deaths are investigated in the United States.
Now, she decides that this George McGrath is far ahead of his time, and she's very interested, and they have these mutual respectful conversations with her ideas being expressed, and even though she's not had a high school diploma, he's taking her very, very seriously. What does she decide to do with her wealth and her tenacity? What does she endeavor to do on behalf of George McGrath and this new idea about instituting a Department of Legal Medicine?
Well, one thing that got her going, one thing she did was she started reading everything she could get her hands on, and she started reading the literature, what there was on criminal justice and forensic science, those sorts of things, sort of getting up to speed. She was a voracious reader. I mean, this woman was amazing. She was fluent in German, French, Latin, you know, so she was reading texts in their original, you know, these European texts in their original language. She started out by simply giving money to Harvard to underwrite a professorship. that she had intended to be for Dr. McGrath, a professor of legal medicine. And so she donated some money to Harvard. And McGrath, by that point, was in the 60s. He unfortunately had health issues, and his health was declining. And so she then, in sitting down with Dr. McGrath, and a lot of it was from Frances's own mind, she had a real grasp. She had an ability to really integrate this information, and she really understood what was needed, and that, you know, in order to move away from the coroner system to a medical examiner system, you really need, it depends on three fundamental things. And the one you need to have the manpower. You need to have doctors who are qualified and trained, who are there to serve as medical examiners. You also need laws reformed and changed to abolish the coroner system, abolish coroner inquests, implement a medical examiner system, and places that had a medical examiner system to reform the laws, to give them more autonomy, more authority, get them involved earlier in the process, and these sorts of things. And then the third component was that you need to address the first responders, which in this case are the police officers. They're the ones who go to death scenes. Sometimes they're the only people who are at death scenes. And so the things that happen at the scene can influence everything else that happens. They don't know, don't move the body. Don't pick up the weapon. Don't walk through blood. You know, these sorts of things. But there was no training. And so they're sort of clumsy and untrained. And so that was very important to teach police officers and other people who were involved in death investigation these tools of forensic science. So she, you know, wrote down a multiple page, I believe it was like 9 pages long, an outline of what a Department of Legal Medicine would do. And really, in those pages, encapsulated an entire medical specialty area of medical practice, forensic medicine, and with training, a training program, undergraduates, a series of lectures for undergraduate students to get medical students more familiar with postmortem changes and these sorts of things, and perhaps interest them in the field to work as a medical examiner, a fellowship program to train people in forensic medicine to work as medical examiners to do research. You need to have a laboratory. You need to have a reference library, which she was working on. You need to have a photography collection to study from and these sorts of things. So she had this whole vision of what this academic medical department should be and what it should do. And then she put her money where her mouth is, and she gave the equivalent of around $3.8 million, if you were to adjust it for inflation, to do just that, and to start this whole program, and to start a national search to find somebody to replace George Burgess McGrath and get the whole ball rolling. And so that's what she did, and she spent a great deal of her fortune towards those ends then.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Bruce, to stop for a second just to talk about our sponsor, which is Third Love. Third Love uses the measurements of millions of women to design bras with all-day comfort and support. Their perfect fit promise, 60 days to wash it and wear it. If you don't love it, returns are always free. Bras in over 80 sizes, including half cups, all made with signature memory foam. My wife Lisa immediately went and took Third Love's Fit Finder quiz. It just took her a minute, and she ordered, as a result, her 24/7 classic t-shirt bra. The bra was very flattering, and she remarked it was very, very comfortable. It fit perfectly, she said. Hands down, the most comfortable bra you'll own. Straps that won't slip and tagless labels, no itching. Lightweight, super thin memory foam cups mold to your shape. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/truemurder to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/truemurder for 15% off today. Now, Bruce, we were talking about this legal medicine department of legal medicine at Harvard, her money being influential. Many of the ideas that she wants to institute are being adopted as a result. She doesn't like taking no for an answer. She employs as many people on her behalf to be able to get this done. This is her passion, to get this done. Now, you talked about McGrath being in poor health and there needed to be a replacement. Who does she find, and what is this person's qualifications in her mind to be able to do this?
She convinced Harvard to put together a committee to do a search, a nationwide search, for a candidate. And the problem was that there was, well, for one thing, there was nobody else qualified in the United States, and there was no medical school doing that kind of training to produce a person another forensic pathologist. And so what they thought to do is to find some very, very bright young pathologist who then they could then send to Europe for a fellowship, for a two-year fellowship at the capitals of forensic science in Europe. And they settled on a young doctor at the Pathology Institute in Cleveland, Ohio, affiliated with the Case Western University, and by the name of Alan Moritz. And he was third in line at the Pathology Institute, which had been established by the Rockefeller Foundation as a model of a pathology institute that provided all the hospitals in Cleveland and really served as a model throughout the country, as a European model of an institute. And so he had sort of hit a wall with his career there at the institute, and was rather intrigued by the prospect of doing something entirely new in pathology, although he wasn't really familiar with the area the legal medicine aspects of pathology. They, through some negotiations, were able to persuade him to uproot his family from Cleveland and come to Boston. And he immediately set off on a fellowship in Europe, went to Edinburgh, all throughout. He went to Paris and Egypt, Cairo, all over. And just on the brink of World War II, they had to sort of make a hasty retreat when war broke out. And then he returned and implemented these concepts and McGrath's concepts, and sort of put together this curriculum at Harvard and built the program from the ground up, and began doing these things and training young doctors in forensic medicine and those sorts of things. So Moritz got the whole ball rolling and got it going.
Now, the other ways that Francis Glessner Leith believed that to further the interest and the cause itself of this Department of Legal Medicine, she tried and met with all kinds of people to try to forward her ideas. You talk about meeting the Perry Mason author. You talk about filmmakers. Maybe we're jumping ahead a little bit, but tell us some of the pursuits that she did endeavor to try to further this cause.
Well, in the 1930s, she visited J. Edgar Hoover, barged her way in, charmed her way in, but she got a meeting with Hoover. Now, Hoover is notoriously unkind to the opinion of women, fired all the female special agents and forbid them from serving in that capacity, and didn't hold them in particularly high regard, but yet you know, this elderly, wealthy woman came calling, and he gave her, you know, had a meeting with her, and she was trying to convince him. And she thought that the FBI was in a position to be, she wanted the FBI to do for forensic medicine what it was doing with fingerprints, to have, you know, to be a national resource, sort of like the way the crime lab is now, that it would, you know, be able to serve police departments throughout the country and consult on cases and those sorts of things. You know, she pointed out to Hoover at the time that the FBI really didn't have a lot of strength in legal medicine, forensic medicine, and it's still true today. It's really not where their strength is. He at the time was developing, this was just after the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, so he was working on getting the crime lab off the ground and was developing the training center, and I just don't think that he had any interest at all in forensic medicine, and for whatever reason didn't. But she, you know, she really had, and this is what she wanted to develop at Harvard, was to make a, you know, a real national institute with a nationwide capability, and help police departments all throughout the country. And that sort of thing never, ever has yet to come to be. But she was very, very important to raise public awareness. You know, if people knew, and McGrath had told her this, if people knew the sorts of horrible things that went on after somebody dies, that people would be outraged and shocked, and they would demand change. So that was a really a big part of her mission, was to, she would, you know, she was an elderly woman with health problems, but she was a relentless speaker at clubs all throughout New England and hitting the road and small clubs and societies and trying to convince people and approaching newspaper people to write about it. And she thought that Earl Sandy Gardner, you know, he was at the time the top selling author in the United States. And, you know, right, what better person to bring this to the American public if you could convince Earl Sandy Gardner and, you know, present that in one of his books, what that would do for the profession would just be immeasurable. So, you know, that was part of her mission, was to reach, ultimately, to reach the public.
There was numerous conversations between Dr. Moritz and Lee. And there is talk about the difficulties that, and even Dr. McGrath, George McGrath, had said the same things, espoused the same sentiment, that there was difficulties, the one major difficulty that he discussed with Francis. What was that, and what light bulb, what idea was set off in her mind at that time?
Are you asking about how to practice observing a crime scene, the scenes?
Yeah, and what that led to, yes.
Yeah, you know, it's she had brought this up with McGrath. The idea had been brought up earlier when she and Moritz, they had first considered doing like a 2-year program, doing some sort of program in police science kind of thing. Didn't get a whole lot of interest in that. The police officers didn't have the prerequisites for that. But they devised a really, really intense week-long seminar in homicide investigation. And in developing the curriculum, which has changed very little to this day, it covers all varieties of types of death and suffocation and sharp force injuries and blunt force injuries and suffocation and all these things and drowning, observing evidence and all these things. But, you know, since it's for police officers, you know, one of the most important pieces of it is the scene itself, because you don't want to tamper anything. You don't want to change anything. And, you know, Morris sort of kind of, you know, he said, well, you know, there's never a crime scene when you need one, and that's also an issue. They just don't, you know, it would be great to take everybody to a real crime scene and use that as a practice. You can't do that for a variety of reasons. They don't happen when you need them. You can't just tromp a whole group of people through a crime scene. So it's just logistically, it wouldn't work. So it was a sort of an obvious answer. Well, yeah, I can make little crime scenes. Sure, that's easy. You know, I can do that. And so, you know, she got this idea of making these little dioramas. And it's basically a set of facts. She made these scenes, and the way she described it, they're sort of capturing a moment. It's like a still frame from a motion picture. Something happened in this space, and it's captured at the moment that you, as the investigating officer, arrives at the scene. You open the door, here's what you see. And so it creates a, and it really does something that can't be done by any other medium. You really could not do that by film, by still photos. I mean, you can show a blood stain, but that's different. I mean, you can photograph a blood stain and see here, there's a blood stain, but that's different than looking at a room and finding it with your own eyes. You look for it. And so, I've talked to many homicide detectives who have been to many crime scenes, and they say that these dioramas are just about as good as going to a real crime scene. They're so vivified, so detailed, and so realistic, and they do something that you can't do with a real crime scene. You can't go back to a real crime scene and check something. Or you have an idea and you've been thinking about it and you want to go see if that was right and these sorts of things. So these are permanent facts, set of facts that can be observed from any angle for as long as you want. You're not told what to look at. You have to look at everything. It's overwhelming because you don't know what you're supposed to look at. So you have to examine every little thing. And so it really was a brilliant, inspired solution to this question of how you practice observing. And so she created these dioramas, spent a fortune on them, literally. Each one of them cost roughly what it costs to build a real house. They were anywhere between $3,000 and $6,000 each, which in the 1940s, you could easily buy a house for that kind of money. And so she finished around 20 of them or so, was working on some others, and 18 of them now survive and are at the medical examiner's office. And they're used for the homicide seminar as she designed them and as they were intended. They're as valuable today and as instructive today as they were when they were made in the mid-1940s.
Incredible. You talk that Francis Glessner Lee develops a real affinity for police officers, for state patrol officers especially. She gets even a police radio and starts listening to the conversations, the communications. Tell us a little bit about how she got this affinity, what she does with it, and how it applies to this legal medicine department pursuit and training.
She did indeed. When she was in her later years, she was losing her sight. She had glaucoma. She was rather isolated up in her estate up in New Hampshire. But she had a radio, and she really lived through that police radio. And she listened all the time, so much so that she was able to discern different personalities. She got to know the different precincts. And divisions, and she really developed in her mind who these people were, and she called them my boys. She befriended police officers, you know, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Massachusetts, all throughout New England, Virginia, and Maryland. She was very good friends with folks in Virginia, and Massachusetts, and New Hampshire, and all throughout New England. And she would lavish them with gifts. She would send baskets of fruit and Christmas and smoked turkeys. And, you know, she called them my boys. And they would correspond with her and tell them the news, the things that are going on, and who had a baby and these sorts of things. And they really, you know, was, they're almost like family. I mean, she had such affection for these people and treated them so well and treated them with respect. And that was really important to her, that, that police officers, the modern police officer, is no longer this uneducated brute who got the coerced confessions with the third degree, but they were educated, they were gentlemen, and that they should be treated accordingly. And she had great regard, particularly for state police. She felt that state police, they were very well trained, very well disciplined. She didn't care too much for FBI special agents. They were a little stuffy and aloof. She had very little regard for county sheriffs, who she felt were tended to be a little less educated and less interested in improving their professional skills and those sorts of things. But state police, they were her. She just loved the state police, and they loved her too. I mean, she was really. She was practically motherly to him. She was always Captain Lee, but was always with respect. I mean, they adored her, and she treated her the police officers very, very nicely.
She wanted them to have specific training, but realized that they didn't have they weren't going to be turning into science majors or get a science degree as a result. So, what did she have them specifically prepared for with this training? And it's interesting that she had enough respect that she basically forced Harvard to accept these state police, which was beneath them to have these uneducated people in their facility, wasn't it?
There was a lot of objection to having cops on campus. And in fact, they drew the line at city police officers. State police, it was one thing, but they did not want Boston cops being on the Harvard campus, and their other faculty members thought it was inappropriate because they were not degree-seeking students, and they openly said, they sent memos, why are we doing this? You know, she really, one of her brilliant insights is understanding that, you know, if I'm a police officer, I don't need to know how a gas chromatography instrument, I'm talking about in the modern age, I don't really need to know how that instrument works. I need to know what that instrument does. That instrument can tell me a level of a substance in the bloodstream. And that's what I need to know, that it is a result, it's been validated, and that is a true result. You know, I don't need to know how DNA. I don't need to know how polymerase chain reaction works and how DNA, the magic that they do in the test tube. But what I need to know is, you know, this is the, here's what a match means, and that's the significance of it. This is what they're capable of doing. So it's teaching them the right things, what they need to know. And even before you teach the police officers, you need to teach their bosses. You need to teach the chief of police what a homicide investigator can do, so they would be deployed. It was important to her that if they have this training in the homicide seminar, that they not be assigned to a desk. So she always interviewed the chief of police first, and they had to buy into the concept that they're going to dedicate this person to be specially trained in homicide investigation and be used. Once they went through the training, they had a duty, they had an obligation to apply this knowledge. So there are no slackers allowed. But you know, she really focused in on what does this person need to know in order to do their job better. You're not making them scientists. That's not the purpose of it. They don't need to be, but it's knowing what they need to know. And that was really, you know, how she focused on. Because doctors, you know, they just want to overwhelm you with facts and these sorts of things. They don't need to know all that stuff. So that's what she did, was to prepare them with the skills that they needed to do their jobs better.
Now, this looks incredible and super promising. And, of course, they make inroads in other states with this idea of overturning the coroner system and replacing with a medical examiner system. But there was trouble at Harvard Moritz has an opportunity to go back to where he wants to go, ideally, and then there's a replacement, a Dr. Ford. Tell us what happens and what direction her dream goes towards eventually.
Yeah, Moritz left in 1949, and you know, they're thrown in a quandary again. And Moritz actually recommended Ford for the job. Ford had been he was the medical examiner in the Southern District of Suffolk County, not McGrath's job, but the one next door, and sort of a known quantity. And initially, I mean, his qualifications were beyond question. He was a very good pathologist. He served in the war and had considerable experience with trauma and these sorts of things, which is a large part of forensic pathology. You know, initially things were promising, Ford and Francis Glessner Lee were on totally different pages in terms of what they should be doing. Ford apparently didn't have much interest in the day-to-day administration, research, you know, the training parts. He wanted to do autopsies and these sorts of things, but not really, you know. She felt in short order that, you know, it was sort of, she said it was morbid. You know, it just, they're not doing anything. But what's more, Ford seemed to, I guess you might say, you know, sort of a PTSD. He had some pretty horrible experiences in World War II, and was known to have a really sharp temper. She finally got sick of it, and you know that she wrote him off, and she can't work with them. And it was just a, you know, she said the department was dying on the vine. It was just dying, and there was nothing she could do about it. And ultimately, you know, she pretty much withdrew from the department, except for the police homicide seminar. She limited to her support to that. And ultimately, in the end, when she died in 1962, she cut Harvard out of her will. So there was that. And Richard Ford, unfortunately, ended up taking his own life. And so that was the end of that.
There were things that angered her along the way, but she made compromises. But at some point, the orders to not incorporate the McGrath Library into a general library was disobeyed. This was an incredible collection of documents and rare books, and from 1,000 books to 3,000 books. And so she felt and wanted to pull her funding, but still maintained those seminars, those homicide seminars, right till the end, didn't she?
That's right. Yes, she did. Yep. Until months before her death. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the status of the books at Harvard. I don't know whether they are, as she requested, all together in one section together. She wanted them kept together as a library. She spent a fortune, but she got some extraordinarily rare documents, and she felt very, very strongly that even if they were subsumed into the medical school library, that they should be together as a collection, as a library. So
MGM wanted to focus, make a film, but have Frances as the part of the focus of the film, and she did not want that. She just wanted to further the cause. MGM brought in a screenwriter, and it's interesting for people my age, I guess, and we talk about one of the stars was Ricardo Montalban in this movie. Tell us a little bit about this movie.
She had an opportunity. She really seized on it, and this was pure Frances Glessner Lee. I mean, this is all her. She took the initiative. She had a contact with the publishing industry in New York, who introduced her to the head writer at MGM in Hollywood, and sort of pitched the idea. And they were intrigued. This was just after World War II. The tastes in entertainment were changing. People didn't want these sort of idealized fantasy films. They were looking for something that was a little more realistic, and they were looking for, they wanted to do the sort of semi-documentary style of filmmaking. They're looking for subjects, and she pitched this idea of focusing on a medical examiner, and it had never been done before. And I read these internal memos that the crime stories, the detective stories, those are as old as dirt, have been done, yeah, every kind of variation of crime stories, but there had not to date had been a movie that focused on the medical examiner and a forensic death investigation. And so they drafted up a story that actually began, the first draft of the treatment or the story of the what was then called Murder at Harvard, focused on Frances Glessner Lee. And there's one of the dioramas, and it during one of the homicide seminars, and the camera sort of zooms in on the burn cabin, and it would flash back to the Frederick Small murder that George Burgess McGrath was investigating, and then tell the story of the legal medicine. She said, literally, she said, "Write me out. I don't want to be. It's not about me. It's about legal medicine. Focus on legal medicine." There had been other stories. There had been. She felt, that she was being used. She was willing to be used, but there were like Saturday Evening Post, Life Magazine, a bunch of newspapers, and then they pick up on this story of this kind of quirky grandma who makes these morbid dollhouses kind of thing. And so, right, she was willing to be used that way if it was a hook that got somebody's interest to do a story about legal medicine. But she really, that's enough. It's not about me. Do a story about legal medicine. And so she was written out. And they actually did take an actual case. The victim's name was Irene Perry, and it was one of Alan Moritz's cases. They fictionalized it. They changed some names to protect the innocent, and they worked in forensic anthropology, ballistics, and what was brand new at the time was forensic photography. And Alan Moritz had some familiarity with that, but it was these ripped from the headlines technology, cutting edge stuff. It was the first procedural forensic drama. They ended up Harvard's objection. They didn't want the title being Murder at Harvard. It was unsavory, and they didn't want to have anything to do with that. And the title said they renamed it Mystery Street. I don't know why they cast Ricardo Montalban as a Cape Cod sheriff. And he does actually explain his accent in the movie they had to, but it's really pretty cool.
Absolutely. Now, with all this hard work, with all of the her inroads into all kinds of areas that would encompass criminal justice, with the police and having this crime scene death investigation as the focus, what were, at the time of her death, what were the inroads in what states, how many states, and overall her huge goal of transforming the U.S. completely from the coroner system to the medical examiner system, how far from that goal did she achieve?
The first medical examiner was in Boston in 1877. She started getting involved in 1929, 1930. By then, if I'm not mistaken, there were really only three metropolitan areas: Boston, New York, and Newark, New Jersey. I believe there may have been in some other places. Maryland came along in 1939. So by 1945, I believe New Hampshire had by then. It was what, at then around 10, was it around 10? It was not a huge number. Today, there's something like, I believe it's 14 states that are medical examiner states, roughly half the country, as of today, half the country is on the coroner system. Most of the major metropolitan areas, the big cities, tend to have medical examiners, but vast parts of the country, half the population is still on the coroner system. Very, very little has changed in many places. Now, you know, some of the qualifications in many places, some are, they do require some training. It can be done, you know, depending on how closely one works with a forensic pathologist. You have to wonder about what sort of facilities they have access to and those sorts of things. You know, it really has not come as far as it really should. I don't know what to tell you. It's really shocking. People think, they watch a TV show like CSI, and people think that that's what happens when something, when somebody dies under suspicious or sudden circumstances, they come to expect that. And the fact is, that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen in most cases. And it doesn't, you know, that sort of thing does not exist in a lot of the country.
Mm-hmm. This legacy, though, I have to applaud you. In 18 tiny deaths, her entire life, her passion, the goals that she had, the ambitious goals, and her fascinating life. Her fascinating life has been captured in 18 tiny deaths. I know she had all kinds of honorary positions when she did die. She was friends with many, many people, treated many, many people in law enforcement very well, and people that went to these seminars were treated incredibly. It is a fascinating story, 18 tiny deaths. The untold story of Frances Glessner Lee and the invention of modern forensics. For those people that might want to look at more information, do you have a website or is there a Facebook page for 18 Tiny Deaths?
There is, in fact, a Facebook page for 18 Tiny Deaths. They can follow me on Facebook. I'm on Instagram as 18 Tiny Deaths. I do have my own website, brucegoldfarb.com, and I have a calendar of events. I'll be doing some traveling around and appearing here and there. People are welcome to come out and see me. If you'd like to, I've gotten from forensic science, criminal justice classes, those sorts of things, college universities. If they're interested in, you know, I'd be glad to do presentations and talk with them about that, about Frances or the history of the forensic science. I'm around.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. It's been an incredible talk with you about 18 tiny deaths and the life of Frances Glessner Lee. Thank you very much. You have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.